has is that we do not need to navigate life stressors on our own. And sometimes the very, very best thing that we can actually do is reach out and ask for help. Of course, we have to be very, very, very careful who we reach out to help for, because, you know, in my certain experience over all these years, I can tell you that just like doctors and dentists, they're not the same. Certainly psychotherapists and psychiatrists are also not the same. So we have to certainly do our due diligence when we are reaching out and asking for help, that we are going to find a provider, that we are going to find a coach who cares, who knows, who's going to help us navigate our life in constructive versus destructive and self-destructive ways. Well, I wasn't actually planning to start the show like this, but hi, everybody. I'm Beatty Cohn-Fredos, and as you know, I am a psychotherapist and a sex therapist and the author of the groundbreaking book on relationships for better, for worse, forever. Discover the path to lasting love. You know, as I was saying to my husband, and as I've said to him for years, I certainly wish that I had had this book when I was beginning my dating and relationship life. It would have made life much, much, much easier. And basically, and, you know, I've been trying to encourage people to listen to and take in my message. And there are three things that we actually need to do if we ever hope to have and find and maintain a healthy relationship. And again, and I know you've been hearing me say this over and over and over again, and yet, unfortunately, we see an increase in the divorce rate and the domestic violence statistics, teenage dating abuse statistics, co-ed dating abuse statistics in university. So again, everybody, if you are ever hoping, wanting, dreaming to have a successful relationship, these are the three things. Number one, you need to make sure, we all need to make sure that we are in a good place emotionally, psychologically, psychiatrically. We have to be responsive and responsible and serious about working out our issues as best as we can, even though we cannot change our history. Because if we are not in a good place, if we are not feeling solid, it is virtually impossible to have a healthy relationship with anybody else. So that's number one. We need to be okay. Number two, we all need to do a better job in being clear and having clarity about the ingredients that go into a successful relationship. And number three is my 10-step formula. And as unromantic and as unsexy as this formula is, it is a formula that educates, it empowers us, and it keeps us safe. And it is an assessment formula. And it cannot be done in a day or in a week or in 2 months. And what my research found is that it takes close to a year to really find out who somebody is and who somebody is not. Now, obviously, if you are seeing a lot of red flags, you are not going to stay in a relationship for the year. You are hopefully going to give yourself permission to exit and extricate any and all toxic relationships as quickly as you possibly can. So people ask me all the time, so what else do you do, Beatty, other than hosting the Ask Beatty Show? Well, I'm a national speaker, and I'm an expert guest on national radio and television. And I'm also the advice columnist for Dan's Papers in the Hamptons and Palm Beach. And most recently, my hometown, I am now the advice columnist for the Winnipeg Jewish News and Post. And of course, I have a private practice here in New York City and also in East Hampton. So in one word, what is the Ask Beatty Show all about? Well, it is about empowerment. We talk about all of the things that we can do, not just think about, but actually do to improve the quality of our lives and our relationships. So what is our talk and conversation about? Of course, we talk about mental health issues and sexuality and relationships. And I have a mantra, and this is a mantra that I really learned from my father, who was my coach off and on the tennis courts. And his mantra, which he taught to me, is basically be willing to acknowledge and address and resolve as best as we can the things that continue to get in the way of our lives and our relationships. Understanding, of course, that we absolutely cannot change our history. And people who know me and people who listen to the show, you hear me using the phrase all the time, lessons to be learned. What have we learned from the trauma, from the disappointments that we may have sustained throughout our life? What lessons? What is our takeaway? Have we a takeaway? And I see so many people over and over and over again repeating the same behaviors with the same kinds of toxic people and expecting different results. And what do we call that? Well, we call that insanity, don't we? If we're doing the same thing over again and it is not working. So again, you have to really be honest with yourself and ask yourself, am I repeating history in a self-destructive or destructive way? And if you find that you can't get out of your own way, this is the very, very best time that you actually can reach out and ask for good help. And I cannot underscore the importance. If you're finding, or if you're thinking about finding a therapist or a coach or a psychologist or a psychiatrist, you really need to do your due diligence, because I have found many situations over the years where the so-called mental health experts have done an enormous amount of harm to the people and patients who they are supposedly there to help. So you don't just look at reviews and you don't just look at the likes. You probably should read my article on how to find a therapist. And I actually go through a number of different things that you need to know about as a consumer when looking for a therapist. Because the fact is that more and more people today are seeing therapists for a variety of emotional, psychological, and psychiatric problems. And this is a good thing. I think when I was a little girl growing up in Winnipeg, nobody talked about seeing therapists or psychiatrists. And if that word even came up, you thought, oh, this person really must be very mentally ill and there must be something terribly wrong with somebody who would go and see a psychiatrist. But the fact is that the average consumer, you're not in a position just on your own to be able to choose a therapist and whether or not the therapeutic process, because we all work in very, very different ways, is actually the right one for you. Because this can literally be one of the most important decisions as an individual that you could be making. And it has the potential for far-reaching consequences, both positive and negative. And I hear more and more people, we go to our devices and we're looking at the reviews and we are looking at the stars and we are looking at the likes. This is not the way to go about choosing a doctor. And my article, it actually appears online in a number of different sites. And the headline is Your Therapist Helping or Harming You? So let me give you some suggestions if you are contemplating or if you are thinking about finding a therapist. Number one, get a referral from someone you trust, and please, please do not be taken in by the splashy ads or likes. So this is going to mean doing a little bit of homework, doing your due diligence. Number two, make sure that the therapist you choose specializes in your particular problems. It is not possible to be an expert in everything. Number three, you want to check his or her license and make sure that there are no past or pending malpractice complaints filed against your therapist. Number four, expect that your therapist will ask you a lot of tough questions about your family background, your relationship history, sex, previous psychiatric problems, including possible hospitalizations, suicide attempts and gestures, medications that you take, prescriptions and over-the-counter, possible addictions, traumas, sexual abuse, sexual assault, affairs, and gender identity issues. And although many of these questions may be very difficult for you to answer, it is vital for the therapist to know these facts so that he or she will be able to make an accurate diagnosis. And this is only possible, so you may not know this, but this is only possible if the right questions are asked and that your answers are honest. And make sure that your potential therapist is on board with this process. And it is not possible to do an in-depth evaluation and diagnosis in a half an hour or in 60 minutes. And so many people these days have told me when they've gone to see other therapists that their sessions are 45 minutes or 50 minutes. And as a Canadian girl who had a mom as a teacher, I learned that 1 hour equals 60 minutes. So all of my sessions are 1 hour sessions equaling 60 minutes. So ask yourself after the first few sessions whether you are in fact comfortable with your therapist. In the beginning, it is going to definitely feel a bit weird. So don't expect a strong level of comfort instantly. Like any relationship, it is going to take time for trust to develop. And if you continue to feel uncomfortable after several sessions, please give yourself permission to go and find yourself another therapist, because there are a lot of therapists with whom you will be able to connect. And remember, too, that there should never be any inappropriate advances, sexual or verbal or otherwise, that occurs between you and your therapist. And if any of this resonates with you where you are not feeling okay, please leave the door and you go out of the office and find yourself another therapist. Number six, does your therapist respect your time and call you back within 24 hours, including evenings and weekends if necessary? You know, I hear from so many people, again, people don't call you back. They don't call you back. Or somebody will tell you that there's going to be an available appointment, follow-up appointment in 2 or 3 weeks. This is completely, completely unacceptable. The fact that the health insurance companies often poorly reimburse therapists and psychiatrists for outpatient mental health should not be your concern. You are entitled to sessions lasting a minimum of 50 minutes, and I find, actually, that longer sessions work even better. And my patients find, and, you know, if it's possible, and certainly not with the majority, that sessions that are lasting 2 to 4 consecutive hours in the beginning really do help to achieve, faster results. So make sure that your therapist is doing, his or her due diligence on this basic level. And if they are not, it is an indication that your therapist is not fully engaged and involved with you. And that is the last thing that you want. Number seven, is your therapist willing, if necessary, to be in contact with your primary care doctor? And this is sometimes really important to be able to rule out any physical problems or prescription medications that actually may be contributing to or causing your emotional or psychological or psychiatric problems. And after a few sessions, you know, your therapist should be able to tell you your diagnosis, including a detailed treatment plan. And I also believe that anything, this is in the beginning, that weekly sessions will not enable you to have the best possible momentum to achieve success in your therapy. Now, what about money? Because therapy costs a lot of money. So if money is a problem, try to negotiate your fee with your therapist or even suggest a payment plan. And I know this is awkward. We don't like to talk about money, and it is the doctor or it is the therapist. But again, it is so important for all of us to ask for what we want. Now, it may not happen, but at least, you know, you can look at yourself in the mirror and you can say, I tried to negotiate the fee. And remember too, that your therapist is just a person. And your therapist is not an all-knowing God or goddess. So that please, please, even though it may be very difficult for you, be assertive. Number eight, you should ask whether your spouse, your parents, your siblings, or children will need to participate in your therapy. Clearly, if you are having relationship difficulties with a parent, a sibling, a child, or a spouse, it is essential, assuming that you feel safe, that your significant others participate at some point in your therapy. And if your therapist is saying to you, I only do individual therapy, and I'm going to have to really believe and buy into your story about what's going on with other significant relationships in your life, that should really be a red flag for you. Number 10, in my opinion, and I've been doing this now for over 35 years, your therapist should fully understand your family background and help you see how the past has affected your present situation and problems, helping you to understand how and why you have learned your self-destructive or destructive behavior. And people will say to me, well, hey, this is the past and we can't really change our history. That's true. We cannot. We cannot change our history, but being able to go back and emotionally understand what did and did not happen in your previous life. I don't mean in another life, but in your history, and why you learned the things that you learned or why you didn't learn the things that you needed to learn to live your life in ways that are in your best interest. These are really important things that people need to go through. So I believe that unless this occurs, your treatment will be bandage therapy at best or a complete waste of time at worst. I had a patient recently. We were looking for a psychiatrist here in New York City. And I'm actually still looking for a psychiatrist in New York City as a backup. And I have so far, after 10 years, I have been unsuccessful in finding someone who is a psychiatrist who I really want to work with. So the psychiatrist, and this just happened recently, you know, told the patient, you know, I think you're too sick for me to want to work with. And she had this initial Zoom with the psychiatrist who charged $1,000 an hour. I think this was a complimentary 2 or 3 minute consult. And these are not the kinds of people that we want to be working with. Number 11, ongoing evaluation, your own evaluation, your self-evaluation, the evaluation that you should be having with your therapist is really necessary in order to determine how well or how badly your therapy is going. Expect that at times you are going to be in a lot of pain. You may wonder why. Well, since good therapy helps you take a hard look at yourself, and deep introspection may make you feel very, very sad about your own self, your family background, what happened and what didn't happen at different times in your life. And although it's true, we can't change the past, we can all learn to understand on a very deep emotional level and accept it and free ourselves from the chains and be able to move forward. And make sure that your therapist is one that periodically evaluates with you how you're doing. I mean, hopefully you come in every week and your therapist will say, well, have you had a good week and how are you doing? And I think there needs to be more of a conversation than just simply, how are you doing? Number 12, you see, I'm asking you to do a lot of homework. And we all need to do a lot of homework because we can never, ever, ever be too careful who we let into our lives. So number 12, successful therapy depends not only on your therapist's expertise, but also on how much time, work, and energy you are prepared to put into the therapeutic process. I can't do it alone. I need you. I need my patients to be my partners. And a good therapist should make that very, very clear. I can't make it better for you. Together, hopefully, we are going to be able to work together and strategize and get you to a place as a team where you're living your life in ways that are really in your best interest. Number 13, the question of medication often comes up, and although no one likes to go on medication, there are certain clinical situations that absolutely require a combination of medication and psychotherapy. And please, please don't beat yourself up if you have found that massage and acupuncture and energy healing and meditation and vitamins and exercise and healthy eating have not done the trick to help alleviate your symptoms, because brain chemistry, it's very complex. So let the experts do their jobs. And if you do need to go on medication, again, find yourself a skilled psychiatrist, not an internist, not a dermatologist, not a dentist, who will work with you to make sure that your medication is on, that it's on. Otherwise, the side effects can be really, really, really depressing and cause you to feel and experience a lot more of depression or anxiety than you initially did. And remember to spend at least as much time, and hopefully a lot more, again, researching your therapist as you would deciding on which car, computer, and cell phone to buy, and making the time and effort to be a wise consumer is going to save you a lot of time, money, and energy. And again, I am very, very curious for those of you who are listening to the Ask BD show right now, whether or not you are thinking about finding a therapist or whether or not you are already in therapy. And I would absolutely love to know what kind of a process you went through, and hopefully there was a process to find your current therapist or psychiatrist. And even more importantly, I'm so curious to know, you know, how things are working for you. The number here on the Ask Bea Show, since we are live every Monday afternoon from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, the number is 888-874-4888. Now, very, very quickly, I want to go over my weekly How Are You Doing segment. And this is a segment, for those of you who may be listening to the show for the first time, which really asks you to be very, very honest with yourself in looking at your mental health, your relationships, your professional and financial life, whether or not you have any substance abuse issues of any kind, to ask yourself how you are doing physically in terms of your physical health, your sleep, your sex, perhaps sexual orientation and gender issues, you know, overall your self-care. And if you find that you are not on track and that you are not living your life in ways that are in your best interest, and we all deserve to live our life in ways that are good for us, right? But if you are finding that you are not on a good path, in fact, that the path that you are on is causing you a lot of distress and pain, again, my question to you, and you know what the question is going to be, is really, what are you willing to do about it? Because it's very, very difficult at times to be fully honest with ourselves. Yet it is our avoidance and denial and blame and self-blame and defensiveness that keeps us in a downward spiral. And I know that I say this all the time, but it's true that it takes a lot of courage to be willing to acknowledge, address, and resolve the things that continue to get in the way of our lives and relationships. And yet look at what the consequences are. If we refuse to step up to the plate and confront our demons, the old ones as well as the new ones, you know as well as I do that it becomes increasingly more difficult to fully engage in life. And as my late father used to say all the time, he used to say, Bini, today is a new day. And that's something that I say to my patients all the time. Yesterday is gone, so today is a new day. So what are we going to do today? What are you going to do today to begin to live your life in ways that are truly in your best interest? And the homework that I give everybody is to just be mindful. And as you go through your day, from the time you wake up until the time you go to sleep, just ask yourself the question, is this good for me? Am I being good to myself? And you may find yourself having these aha moments and saying, for example, no, I don't need this extra piece of cake because I'm really wanting to lose some weight. Or no, I shouldn't have this drink, or I shouldn't have this cigarette. So it's about being mindful, and all of this, it's not easy, which is why, and when you think about it, the athletes, actors, so many people have coaches that help us to stay on our game. So why not, if you're needing a coach for a short period of time, why not be good to yourself again and try to find somebody who can coach you for a period of time and help you get on a really constructive path once and for all? So what do you think? Again, what do you think? This would be, you know, just so amazing if we were all in a room together and we could interact and we could look at each other and you could ask me questions. Of course, you can definitely ask me questions during the show. Again, the number is 888-874-4888. Well, there were a couple of articles in the New York Times that I really wanted to discuss with you. The first one, the headline was, "My friend won't leave her abusive husband. What should I do?" And this was the letter. "I have a good friend whom I love and care about. She is married to a man whose alcoholism has gotten worse over the years. He is also both verbally abusive and controlling of her. They have a son who's 12. My friend participates in Al-Anon, a support group for friends and family, and is also going to therapy. We talk about once a week. She tells me awful stories about her husband's drinking and subsequent abuse. I've talked to her about leaving and emphasized the support that I and other friends would give her, and she maintains that she is not ready to leave." Well, one of the things that I have learned after all of these years as a practicing psychotherapist and sex therapist is that we cannot force anybody to do anything that they want to do or that they are not ready to do. All we can do is point things out if they are interested in hearing our opinion. All we can do is encourage people to do things that are in their best interest. But you can stand on your head. And if someone is not wanting to leave, whether or not they are in an abusive situation or whether they're just in a very, very unhappy situation and they continue to talk about the abusive situation or the unhappy situation and are not yet ready to leave, there's absolutely nothing that you can do. However, in this particular situation, and this was in the New York Times section called The Ethicist. And the person who responded in this ethicist column omitted what I feel is something very, very important. And that is that this woman, this married woman who is living with an alcoholic and who's also very abusive, they happen to have a son who is 12 years old. So in my professional opinion, this is a child protection issue. Now, the last thing that we ever, ever want to do is bring child protection and social workers into people's lives. However, this 12-year-old boy is at risk, even if his father is not verbally or physically hitting him or abusing him. And this good friend who is trying to get her friend to leave her abusive husband, she needs to point this out because this boy is at risk and is living in an abusive home. So if the married woman who's living with the abusive husband doesn't want to do anything for her for herself, then the friend has a I feel a moral and an ethical responsibility to contact child protection in order to protect the 12-year-old boy. Now, I'm really curious what you would think about this because the friend isn't going to leave, okay? We've tried, we pointed out all of the red flags and the reasons why she should leave her abusive husband, but she said it. She said it very, very clearly. I am not ready to leave. And what was interesting too in this article pointed out that this woman has a good job with benefits and a salary so that it is not a financial issue. But someone, and this woman's good friend needs to think about what is going on with this 12-year-old boy so that if the mother and married woman is not prepared to make any changes in her life in terms of living in an abusive family, the friend has a moral and also a legal responsibility, I feel, to contact child protection and make sure that this boy is going to get whatever help that he, I'm sure, needs. And this could also be a really, really important wake-up call for both the mother and for the father, realizing the damage that is happening to their son as a result of the dynamics in the family. So, as you know, I'm taking a very, very, very strong position about this. Also, in this Ephesus column, there was another article that I thought was really, you know, really kind of interesting. And the headline is, "My friend is dating a murderer. So should I do anything about it?" First of all, you can't do anything about it. If you have concerns about the fact that your friend is dating a murderer, who, by the way, he's in prison and he still has 11 years left on his sentence, although he is trying to appeal for a lesser term. So the woman who wrote in says, "I'm hoping that their relationship will end before he is released. Otherwise, I fear for her safety and I can see the red flags every day. What can I do to help?" Well, again, in the same kind of a situation as the previous article, all you can do is lovingly point out your concerns and point out the specific red flags. And again, you can point them out and you can express your worries or your concerns, but this is an adult woman. And if she believes that she wants to continue having a relationship with this man who is in prison, and if she believes that he has made some changes, and of course we will never know whether or not he's made any changes until he is released. Because a relationship, just think about this, that a relationship that takes place when one party is in prison doesn't tell you very much about what things will be like once that partner has been released. Because in prison, physical violence can't occur when two people are meeting only under supervision. And the incarcerated partner has a strong incentive to behave well in order to maintain a relationship that may be one of the few positive elements in his life. So it is way too soon to know how this is going to play out if and when he is released. And again, as a friend, you have communicated your concerns. And that is really all you can do. And in the final analysis, we cannot change anybody. I, as a therapist, cannot change anybody. I can point things out. I can encourage people to change. And in the final analysis, that is going to be a decision that somebody makes, or a decision that somebody refuses to make. And there is nothing that you or me or anybody else can do about it. Which brings me to an article that I wrote for Dance Papers in the Hamptons and in Palm Beach, and I think also for the Winnipeg Jewish News and Post. And this really fits in perfectly to what I am speaking about right now. And the issue is, think about this, are you enabling people to hurt you? My children disrespect me. He cheats on me. She drinks too much. She refuses to have sex. He abuses me physically, emotionally, sexually. These are typical complaints that I hear from my patients on a regular basis. This is when they start therapy, not when they end therapy. It's certainly disappointing, frustrating, and at times frightening to be in a dysfunctional, an unhappy relationship. However, an all-important underlying question that we all need to be willing to answer honestly is not so much, why is this person doing this? Why are my children disrespecting me? And why is he cheating on me? And why does she drink too much? But the real issue, the real fundamental question is this. And that question is, why am I allowing? What is it about me that I am allowing my partner, my children, my colleagues, my friends, or my business associates to disrespect and hurt me? So that is the first question. It's not about why is he doing this to me or why is she doing this to me. I mean, we can have a lot of conversation about somebody else's psychology, but the real question, the fundamental question is, why am I allowing people to disrespect me and hurt me? But that's only question number one. Question number two, which is even a more important question, is what, if anything, am I prepared to do about it? Am I going to complain? Am I going to whine? Am I going to moan? Am I going to be upset for weeks or months or years? But what am I prepared to do about someone who is hurting me and who is disrespecting me? Look, the reality is that no relationship is perfect. There are always going to be issues, large and small, that need to be acknowledged, addressed, and resolved, again, as best as we can resolve certain things. And no one likes confrontation. But if we are not able and willing to let the people in our lives know when they have overstepped their boundaries, and that we will not tolerate their disrespectful or abusive behavior, we cannot expect that their behavior is going to change, right? And why would it, when there are no consequences? And believe it or not, there are people who may not even be aware of or even care how their behavior is hurting you, which is why in my How Are You Doing segment, when I ask you to really look at the relationships in your life, whether or not they are loving and basically happy or functional or dysfunctional or toxic, it's important to be able to acknowledge the reality of what it is that is going on or not going on. And then, of course, the big question is, what are you going to actually do about it? Because in every relationship, as I said, people dance the dance. And at times, we are in step with each other. And those are wonderful times. And at other times, it is the missteps that seem to define our relationships. And what do we do when we discover that the dance is no longer fun and in fact has become unbearable or even dangerous? So I'm asking you again right this moment to just take a quick little checklist of the various different relationships in your life and ask yourself whether or not they are working for you or not. And if they're not, again, the question is, what are you prepared? What are you willing to do about? Because we do have choices, although it may seem at times that we don't. These are the choices. We can do nothing. As many, many, many people who I have treated over the years before they came into therapy, they were in dire situations and just either didn't know what to do or didn't feel that they could really do anything. So we can do nothing. That is an option. We can complain. We can complain for weeks and months and years, and that is another option, right? We can withdraw. and be very passive aggressive about how we are feeling about the situation, we can threaten to leave. Or we can accept the role of doormat. Okay, I am going to be a doormat, and that is the role that I am accepting. We can also hope and dream that things will get better on their own. Or, and this is the big or, we can make a decision that we no longer will enable or accept the status quo and begin to make preparations to exit the toxicity. If you have tried every possible thing to try to see if at least on your part that you've done whatever it is that you feel that you could try to do to improve the relationship. And if there are no changes after a reasonable period of time, you need to seriously think about making preparations to exit the toxicity. What is an enabler? And I think that that's something that maybe we should be very, very clear about the terms. What is an enabler? An enabler is someone who, for a variety of reasons, typically what I have found, beginning in one's family of origin, family background, has learned to feel powerless and has learned and is willing to accept destructive and self-destructive behavior. We make excuses. It's not so bad. I mean, I remember having a patient years and years ago, and she came in initially to see me. And she said, well, I basically have a good marriage, but only once or twice a year when we're away on a trip and he drinks too much that he hits me. So this is a woman. This is a woman who learned to rationalize her husband's abusive behavior by saying, oh, well, it only happens once or twice a year. And with this particular woman, and I haven't really thought about her in years and years, she was someone who was beaten daily by her parents when she was growing up as a child. So clearly she learned consciously or unconsciously that being hurt and hit just once or twice a year was, in quotes, an improvement, which of course it was not. And what happened in this particular situation, we had husband come in, and this is a woman who, for the first time in her life, she was able to really take her power and do something about it. And I remember we were sitting in my office, and she turned to her husband and she said that if you ever hit me again, I will divorce you. And he sat there and he was stunned, because for years and years and years, this woman, basically lived her life as a doormat. She was a pleaser. She wanted to be loved. So she basically allowed and enabled him to run the show. And I remember seeing them at an event a couple of years after we finished our therapy. And she looked at me and she said, things are okay. But it took a lot. Took many, many years for this woman to get to a point and with me, with a coach, where she was able to understand that a little bit of poison, a little bit of toxicity is still poison. And that you've heard me say, I have zero tolerance for whether it's a little bit of toxicity or a lot of toxicity. And I'm hoping I can convince you also to have zero tolerance for poison of pieces, people, for a little bit of poison or for a lot of poison. And, some of these, some of the explanations, why people will stay in these toxic relationships, really include fear of abandonment and financial ruin, fear of being alone, obviously poor self-esteem, not knowing what a healthy relationship is, a family history where these types of behaviors were normalized and accepted, or a conscious or unconscious false belief that somehow he or she is to blame. It's her fault for the abuse and is therefore deserving of maltreatment. And this is why it is so important to go back and help people to look at in depth at their family histories and to try to figure out what happened or what didn't happen when they were growing up that got them to a place in their lives where they enabled and even encouraged maltreatment. And although some or all of these fears and beliefs may be real, I mean, the abandonment, financial ruin, fear of being alone, that this is the thing. They're real. I'm sure many of them are real. The enabler plays a very, very important role in keeping the dysfunctional dynamic going. And you may not think about it like that. You are a powerful player if you happen to be an enabler. And it does take a lot of courage to be able to say enough is enough and be willing to walk away from a toxic situation. Yet many people, and I've seen this for many, many years as a psychotherapist, that many people remain in untenable situations because of their own fears and unresolved problems. So again, it boils down to us and what are we prepared to do? Are we willing to work through our stuff, our histories, our traumas, and be able to live our lives in ways that are truly in our best interest rather than live our lives in the destructive and self-destructive patterns that we may have learned and picked up over the years. The reality, however, is that sooner or later, these toxic relationships have the potential to destroy us emotionally, psychologically, or even physically. So again, I'm asking you to take an honest look at your relationships, your current relationships, the people who you deal with, the people who are in your life, the people who you interact with on a regular basis. And hopefully you're one of the lucky people where you have learned that being in a loving relationship with people who care about you, people who have compassion and sensitivity, that these are the people who you have collected throughout your life. And again, probably beginning with your own parents. But if you are going through your Rolodex of people and you're saying to yourself, wow, I never really quite thought of it in that way, but I don't like the way he treats me or I don't like the way she talks to me. Again, instead of just complaining about what the people do or don't do to you that contributes to your upset and your anger and your depression and your unhappiness, I'm just throwing the ball back at you. And I'm asking you right now to think about what you are willing and what you are prepared to do, not just think about and dream about, to stop enabling people who continue to hurt you. I want to very, very quickly read a letter. This was a letter that was sent to me in Dan's papers. And says, "Dear BD, I'm a 27-year-old professional woman who's been in a relationship with John for the past 2 years. He has cheated on me, and at times our relationship has become violent. He has legal problems because of his drug issues, but still refuses to get help. It's like, why? Why would this woman be with this kind of a guy? You probably think I'm crazy, but I really love him. We've broken up many times, but always end up getting back together. I recently found out that I'm pregnant and really don't know what to do, and I need need some advice. Wow. Well, I say to you is, why do you think that you stayed in such an abusive and dysfunctional relationship with someone who has hurt you over and over again? I mean, John clearly has his own problems. And again, I'm asking her to think about, did you come from an abusive family where you may have learned that abuse was a normal part of a relationship? So I'm wanting her to really think some things through. Where did you learn that your needs for love and security are not important? You say that you love him. However, it sounds like there is little of anything loving about your relationship. Again, love is not abuse. It is about respect, commitment, consideration, sharing, caring, patience, empathy, trust, and a willingness to work out problems. But I went on to say that since you're about to become parents, it would be the perfect time to get some much needed professional help, both individually and as a couple. And if he refuses to go, you need to go by yourself, because do you really, bottom line, do you really want to bring an innocent child into the toxicity? Her world is toxic. It is poisonous that you describe. And I say, you know, let me know if, you know, I can help in any way. So here's another example of a woman, Amanda, who over and over and over again has allowed and enabled her boyfriend to abuse her in a variety of different ways. So I'm hoping that today's show is motivational and inspirational, and that if you have some work to do to stop some toxicity, today is a new day, like my dad used to say, so you can begin today to make some changes. So I want to leave you with my two weekly messages. And of course, the first, and this is what this whole show is really all about, to make sure that you are doing everything possible to live your life in ways that are in your best interest. It is not selfish, and that means to love yourself. And secondly, we all need to do a much, much, much better job in this world in learning to love each other and accept each other and embrace ourselves and come together. So again, I want to thank you all so much for listening, as you do every single week, and for sending me emails and questions. And I hope you're going to have a really good rest of the day and a good week. And I know that there's lots to think about here. I'm throwing a lot at you. So again, have a good day, a good week, and I will talk with you next Monday from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And take good care. Bye.